Okay, well, it would not be a presentation in Tech Ed Australia if I did not start off with the good eye. There you go. I'm done now. You won't hear me trying anything else after that, as far as my Australian. Actually, I'm really excited. I am really excited to say good day because I've been at Microsoft for about 8 years. My name is Glenn, for those of you who don't know me. And when I first came to Microsoft, I learned about all these tech ed conferences all over the world. And everybody learns about the back-to-back Tech Ed Australia and New Zealand. And at that time, I was like, I would love to do something like that, but it's like a two-week commitment, and I could never see myself doing that. And now I've probably traveled for 2 to 3 weeks, probably 20 to 30 times. So flash forward 8 years later, I'm finally here. I really am excited to be here with you guys, and this is an amazingly beautiful country, and one that I think not enough people from the States come to visit. I will say, on the other hand, though, that I've met several people while I've been here, and I said, hey, have you ever been to the States? And they're like, you know, I never really had the desire to go there. So that is, don't know how to respond to that one. But anyway, that's not why we're here. But I want to thank you guys all for coming. It looks like we've got a really good group. You might have to let some people sit on your lap. No. If we get there, that's a really good place, actually. So I work on the Azure Mobile Services team. There's a little bit of a missing word in this title. The title should be Deep Dive into Node.js Scripting. So just to set context, everything we're going to do today is around working with Azure Mobile Services. So let me switch over. So by show of hands, we've got to do the venerable survey. How many people here actually are familiar or have worked with Azure Mobile Services? Just a few. So just to set context, I'm not going to tell you to leave. You will learn about Azure Mobile Services as we go. I'll give you a quick, like, 5 minute of what it is. But this is really targeting people that are familiar with Azure Mobile Services and want to go to the next level. But it won't be too overwhelming, but I'm not taking you through all the basics of what Azure Mobile Services is. But at a high level, what is Azure Mobile Services? It describes it right there. You're creating a backend for a mobile application. It's making it really easy for you to say, hey, I am a client-side developer, for example, who has a mobile app, an iOS app, or an Android app, or a Windows Phone app, or a Windows 8 app, and hey, it works really good locally on that device, and it's cool. I can write data locally and store it, but what if I want that really to scale out? Then I need to think about having a backend. I need to think about getting that data off of the device, especially if, how many people here have more than one device? So you want to be able to access that data from whatever device you're using. That means it's got to get off of the device. That data's got to live somewhere. And what Azure Mobile Services really is about is saying, hey, we'll give you the chance to create a mobile service backend that your front ends can actually talk to. And a key thing about Azure Mobile Services is that it's really targeting getting you going without you having to learn how to be a full-fledged server-side developer. Not to say that you're not capable of being a server-side developer, but imagine your boss shows up to you one day and says, hey, we need to have this mobile app. And you're, okay, so I start learning how to build my mobile client. But no, it needs to have a backend. It needs to deal with OAuth. It needs to deal with Twitter and Facebook. It's got a lot of things that it needs to do, and that's going to be overwhelming for you. So Azure Mobile Services is designed to really provide an on-ramp to get you to building that backend for that mobile app without having to become an expert. But what this talk is about is actually, well, intended to be, what happens when you outgrow that? Where can you go next? And that's going to be the crux of where we're going to focus now. But being that so many people have not done it, I will just take you through a very quick hello world. How many people here have developed mobile applications? And are those Windows or iOS or Android? How many are doing iOS? Android? Windows? Fair split. So Microsoft has been going through a lot of changes. And one of the changes is we no longer care just about Windows. I think it's fair to say for a long time, all we cared about was Windows. And all we cared about was Visual Studio. And that whole mentality has evolved, much in thanks to the cloud. So we now realize, hey, there's other devices out there, like iOS, like Android, et cetera. And so Azure Mobile Services decide to work with all of them. So I'm just going to take you through the very basics of an Azure Mobile Service. And then we will move on from there. And every time I switch, I'm going to have to like think about it. Oh, that's wrong. Let's see.
Is it that one?
There we go. So before we jump in, this is primarily what we're going to cover once we get you through the kind of Hello World basics, which is that Azure Mobile Services, when you're building up that backend, it is actually a backend that is hosted as a Node.js application. And Node.js is a technology, a stack, that has really been gaining a lot of traction that allows you to build server-side applications in JavaScript. And you'll cringe until you actually work with it. And then once you work with it, you'll learn to love the power that it has. And with mobile services, we felt that, hey, JavaScript is a language that a lot of developers, not just Windows developers, Android developers, iOS developers, know and they're comfortable with. So that is what we used on the back end. Not to mention that Node is just highly scalable. It handles large numbers of concurrent requests. And when you're building mobile backends, this is actually a key component of building like an API, is that it is probably going to be very I/O intensive. It's going to be talking to things like MongoDB and Redis and SQL Server and MySQL and message queuing mechanisms. And all of these things are very I/O intensive. And that's why we built Azure Mobile Services in Node. So once we get past those basics, we're really going to focus on this really cool feature of mobile services, which lets you write custom logic as scripts. So in JavaScript, and we'll see that in a minute. And then we're going to go into how we can take that scripting experience much further to do some really, really cool things. And if you have questions, you can raise your hands. We've got a bunch of time. So, but don't ask me questions on what is a mobile service, because I'm going to show you that now, and we will go from there. So Windows Azure. I'm not going to go into what Windows Azure is, but Windows Azure is a service that offers mobile services. It's a cloud hosting service. And this, when I switch, please let me know, by the way, if I'm not switching, like throw something at me or point a finger or just yell out, you're doing it again. This is the Windows Azure portal, which is an HTML5 portal for managing your Azure account. And you can see here that I'm looking at my list of mobile services. Each of these mobile services is a backend for one or more clients. And so I can go here and I can create a new mobile service. So I'm just going to go create a mobile service. And it's going to ask me for a name. And I will say, let's see, GB to-do list 2, because I already have a to-do list. And you'll see that it actually says, hey, do you want to create a new database or use an existing? I'm going to use an existing. Mobile services uses SQL Server behind the scenes, Azure SQL. But it's designed to make it almost feel like a NoSQL database. And you don't have to get into like writing stored procedures, modifying table schemas. It does all of that for you. And you'll see that right now. So I've got my subscription. I'm going to choose my region. We'll choose East Asia. And I already have a server that's created. I'm just going to use that existing database, and I'll just put my password in. Say a prayer. I always say a prayer at this point. This is when things could fail. Fortunately, I'm not relying on creating anything today because everything else has already been created. So it's creating a mobile service. So what is that doing for me? It's provisioning a Node backend, which is where my app will live. It is creating for me an Azure SQL database instance, or in this case, I already have a database, so it's adding some tables for me. It's wiring all that stuff up. And one of the things that Azure Mobile Services does that's really nice is as you start to create places for data, it automatically creates APIs for you. It's got a lot of conventional-based stuff going on, which we'll see in a second. So this is going to take a minute or two. Just give it a minute. Anybody have a song they want to sing or a poem they want to share? Should be almost done. Come on. You can do it. There you go. First demo worked. I think I need a round of applause for that, because that's not always the way. So I've now created this thing called a mobile service, GB To Do List 2. And you can see when I go in that it actually says, hey, choose a platform. So we support all these different platforms, Windows Store, Windows Phone, iOS, Android, all the things I said. We even have an HTML5 SDK. So you can actually write single page applications that use Azure Mobile Services as a backend. Or, more interestingly, you can use things like PhoneGap to create a native application that you write in HTML using that SDK. So I'm going to go with iOS. And so you can see here I have this getting started, and it says, hey, create a new iOS app or connect to an existing iOS application. Now, let me make it clear. We're not saying that every single time you create an app, you're going to go through this create a new app. It's just to get you started. We do show you how to connect to an existing app regardless of which platform you choose. We'll show you here's how you get the libraries, here's how you wire up your existing clients. But we're just going to start with the basic one, and anybody who's seen any talks on mobile services probably has seen this demo, and I'm going to try to get out of it as fast as I can. So I've now created this mobile service, and it says, hey, to get me started, it says when you store data in your mobile service, you use a table. Table in mobile service is really a logical concept, but by default, it is backed by an Azure SQL table. So it will automatically create a SQL table for you when you go to create a table. So I'm going to go hit this create to-do item table. And it's going to take a few seconds. And then it's going to tell me that my table has been provisioned. It says, hey, we've created the to-do item table for you. And it says, now, if you want, you can just download your app and start to work with it. So I'm going to click download. And this has generated for me a starter Xcode application. It's an iOS application, Xcode project that I'll open in a second. And it is already wired up to talk to my mobile service. So one of the things that happened when I created that table, that to-do item table, it also automatically created an API, an endpoint for accessing that table over HTTP, which is what the mobile clients will do. But you could just use, what's nice about it is you could even just use Fiddler or Charles or any one of your favorite HTTP inspection utilities to basically just fire off requests at your mobile service, even from a browser. You can just put a get URL in. Okay, so I'm going to open my Finder, and we can see that I have GB To Do List 2, and I'm going to expand that out. Where is it? Here it is. Nope. So I have an Xcode project. So I'm going to open that Xcode project up. Now, one of the things I want to show you is before I actually run this, if we go back to look at our API, our mobile service. So I click on data, and you see now that I actually have a to-do item, which was the thing that I created. If I click into that, you'll see that all it has is an ID. You saw that ID flash up there for a second. It has no structure. So if I want to store data, probably I need to do something, like specify the fields, modify the database. Isn't that what you would expect? Well, actually, we've done something I think you'll like to really help the iterative process. So I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to keep this table empty as it is, and I'm going to go back over to Xcode, and I'm going to run my app, which will run in the iPad simulator. So, I just did do the demo. Now, that stored something somewhere, because I'm telling you it stored it somewhere, right? You don't believe me. I will jump over here, and we'll do a refresh. You can see now that it no longer just has an ID. It now has a text field and a complete field, and it has the data that was just populated. So how does that actually work? Mobile services, by default, uses this thing called dynamic schema. And what dynamic schema means is these APIs are accepting JSON objects. We will look at the structure of that JSON object if dynamic schema is enabled, and we will automatically migrate the database and add in the fields that are necessary. And that's really nice because it gives you kind of a client-driven developer experience where you can just say, ooh, I want to now add this new field, and you can just add it onto your JSON object, and suddenly it will automatically be propagated to the back end. Now, you probably don't want to do this once you actually go to production. You don't want people to arbitrarily be able to just modify your database structure. That's probably not a good thing. So you can absolutely go and disable that. If I go back to my service and I go to the Configure tab, so the first thing you'll see is I actually have a link that tells me what the SQL database is and the server is. This is your database server provisioned within your account. We give you a free one. If you want to grow, you can specify whatever Azure SQL database instance you want, whatever specs you want to use, but you can start off very small for free. And then you can use the SQL tools that are out there, like SQL Manager, to manage this database and connect to it directly. You can add triggers, you can add stored procedures, you can do whatever you want. It's your DB. But by... What happened? Huh? Oh, no. Okay. Yeah, it's, I don't know how to disable... I have to, like, disable that on the Mac. Hold on, maybe I should do that. No, we'll just leave that going. We'll just... It'll be entertainment. Hopefully it wasn't anything bad. This is what we have editors for. Okay, so hopefully nobody was cursing me. So anyway, so I can, all I got to do is click this off. And once I click off and I save it, I now no longer allow you to send me dynamic schema. So I have control. And you could even imagine that you'll have maybe like a staging mobile service where you develop out of. And there you always keep dynamic enabled. And then your production one, you don't. All right, so that's mobile services, and you saw the basics. We do a lot more with identity. We make it really easy to hook up OAuth. You can basically hook up Facebook and Twitter and say that, hey, developers that use my mobile service can authenticate with one of those mechanisms. They can authenticate with Google and Microsoft account. Or you can even create your own authentication mechanisms. That's beyond the scope of this talk, so I'm not going to go into that. But what I am going to touch on, because we're going to go deeper into this, is this concept of scripting. So I have a table here, and that table actually can have a script behind it. So here I have an insert operation. Don't think of this like a trigger on a database, because it is not. It may feel like that, but it's not. It's logically associated with a table, but it's a place where I can write JavaScript that executes as this API is getting accessed. Then I can basically work with all the CRUD operations, create, update, delete, read. So what would I want to do here? Well, the simplest thing I might want to do is actually add a created at field. So I want to say that whenever a user goes and creates an item, I'm automatically going to tack on a date, like a timestamp, for example. And this is just a very simple example of what you would use scripting for, and we're going to see some really sophisticated examples. But I'm just going to save this now. And I'm going to go back to my simulator, which should be around here somewhere. Where is it? Let's see. Where did I put it? There it is. So now I'm going to say another item. So I just added another item. But let's go look at the back end again. And let's refresh the data. So we'll hit on to-do item. So see how we now got a created date. I can do lots of things on this in these scripts. I can do validation. I can actually make HTTP calls out to other systems. This is Node. So basically think about it that you've got a really rich set of functionality that's available when you write those scripts. Somebody had a question. Yes?
You mentioned about staging mobile services and productions. How do you migrate
So the question was, if I do staging and production, how would I manage that? So one of the features, so in terms of the code, one of the ways you'll do that most likely is using the source control feature that I'm going to show you. As far as the data goes, we actually have a capability in Azure now called Data Sync. And using Data Sync, you could actually sync between two databases. So that's one way you could potentially say that, hey, if I have structural changes, I might be able to use Data Sync to do that, or extract DDL myself and run the SQL. If I change my database, the call may not. Well, if you're doing so, so what you're saying, if I'm doing like say Windows development or iOS development, I have code on the client that relates to the structure. So I would add a property or add a field. Just because the structure has been modified on the server to allow new fields, those fields are not going to surface to the client. Unless the client definitions, like if the client has classes, if it's C#, those classes may have properties on them. If you don't put those properties on there, yes, they're not going to show up. So the client would need to get revved to be able to show the new data, unless you're doing like a WinJS app. If you were doing like a JavaScript application or like a SPA, a single page app, then it, because it's just loose JSON objects, anything that's added on the server will automatically show up. That's not a mobile service specific thing, though. It's just the nature of writing a client and you have some strongly typed representations of the data on the client and you need to modify that to be able to show the new data.
So when you migrate the database, you have to turn on that the dynamic stuff while you're doing that, or can you just leave it off?
No, you don't have to turn anything on. You basically would be working with the today what you would be doing, I'm going to move on because I don't spend too much time on this. Let's carry on with this afterwards, but I'll just leave it like this. Today what you would be doing is you'd be working with like either Azure tools or SQL tools to sync the schemas up. There's no built-in migration path within mobile services today to say, oh, I have this thing called a staging thing, and mobile services knows about it and keeps the two in sync. But there are mechanisms that you could do that. And I'm going to move on, but we can follow up later. So the other thing I can do in these scripts, I can add validation, push notifications. So as soon as you as a developer start to move outside of the context of your mobile app and you start putting data and stuff into the cloud, you also want to utilize this really great capability that all these mobile platforms support, which is push. Like if I'm using iOS, there's APNS, which is requires me, though, to have a server somewhere to do that push. So in these JavaScript scripts for your tables, you can actually work with. We give you node objects that you can work with for doing APNS and WNS and MPNS and GCM, which are all the different push mechanisms that exist out there for the major mobile platforms. So then you can have it that, hey, when some data is updated, I actually send back a push notification to let the user know, hey, that data was persisted, or something like that. Does that make sense? OK. So I'm going to move off of the basics, which originally I wasn't planning to do, but you know, for sake of all the people here that are now familiar with mobile services, I thought it was worth it. All right, so let's move out of basic land. Hold on to your seats. So when we talk about Node.js, actually, I have a slide for that. Let me go back to this. So for those of you that are not familiar with Node, you can go to nodejs.org and you can learn more about what this is. But in your mind, you can think of it as something like Ruby or PHP or Java or .NET. That's the vein that you would think about it in. And Node has this concept, which has been pushed in JavaScript for a long time, of modules. So if you come from the .NET world, you know about NuGet, which is our package manager. In Rails, there's gems. PHP has their own equivalent, and Maven in Java. Well, for Node, it's NPM, the Node Package Manager, which you can find by going to npmjs.org. And there are 40,000 modules and counting. For anybody who's been following the Node community, that is incredible. I mean, the Node community is only a couple of years old, and the modules have been more than doubling every year. So it's growing at an exponential rate. And that is just anything you can think about doing, there's a Node module for it, is the basic premise. So we actually include a set of modules by default to help you to solve common problems with Azure Mobile Services. Well, what kind of common problems? Not that. So we have storage services in Windows Azure. Is anyone here familiar with our storage services? Table, Blob. These are services that allow you to store data or store documents. We have Service Bus, which is a messaging mechanism. And we have queues and a ton of other services. So imagine you're building an app where the user is going to upload an image. And you need to give them permission to store that image. So they're basically going to like run the app and select an image on their machine, and they're going to upload it. But you don't want anybody in the world to be able to upload. You actually want them only to be able to have a small window and like a token where they can use that token for a moment in time to be able to upload that image. And for that, Windows Azure actually has a feature called shared access signatures. And you can issue a URL that you could give to a user and say, here, use this. And it's a one-time usage, and it expires after a certain amount of time. Well, to do that, you need to have a server, because the client's not going to have the permission to do that. That's going to be something you're going to push onto the server. Maybe the user doesn't even have permission to be able to upload, period. But assuming they do, so we actually have a module for Node called the Azure module. And the Azure module, if you're familiar with, say, the .NET SDK that we have for Azure, which allows you to work with some of these services from .NET, provides the same capability to do that in Node. So because we provide the Azure module for Node out of the box in mobile services, that means I can do things like create a SaaS URL. I can also utilize other services. So there are third-party services in this cloud world, and one of them is a really cool service called SendGrid. And all SendGrid does is it gives you the ability to blast emails. It's email as a service. I don't need to have a server that I run. I simply just sign up for the service, I get some credentials, and then I can basically utilize SendGrid to send my mails for me. Well, we provide that module out of the box. And we also provide the ability to do push notifications, and I talked about earlier how we allow you to do that. But one of the things that we provide in the Azure module is access to this new feature that we've added to Windows Azure called Notification Hubs. And what Notification Hubs really is for is it allows you to do pub/sub, where you can basically have multiple subscribers on different devices, and you can tag the information that you're going to publish with different types of tags, and a user can say, here's the tags I'm interested in. And Notification Hubs manages all the plumbing for you to basically say, all you have to do from within your script is say, I'm now pushing a message, and here's the tag of this message, or tags, plural, and then automatically the clients that subscribe to those tags, even if there's millions of them, will automatically get those notifications. So these are just some of the common scenarios that we support out of the box. So let's see what it's like to work with the built-in modules. So I have a mobile service here, and it's called Gblock Pick Service. You'll notice a pattern here that everything is most things are prefixed with Gblock or GB. That's because that usually relates to a URL, and those URLs all have to be unique. Two people can't have a mobile service called My Service. That's just not going to work because of the URL namespace. So I've got this service. It's got these two tables. Let me first run it so you can see what the app does. Now I have to say a different prayer, which is that Parallels actually comes back. It looks like it is, so that's good. Okay, so I'm just going to run this application, and we can see that this is a Win8 app, and it has this My Pictures is the name of the application, and you can see there's some pictures there. I think this guy's actually in the audience. There he is, Brendan. So it gives me the ability to browse on my machine and upload images, which are then accessible. And it's using Azure's blob storage to store those images. But this is that scenario that I just described to you, which is what I want to do is basically give the client permission for a moment in time to say, put your image here. And then after that, if they try to do it again, that's going to fail. So if I come here and I go click upload, you'll see that it says, hey, you can select a picture. So I'm going to select the picture. And it gives me my standard Win8 kind of stuff. So this is actually the Skype team. I went down and met with a bunch of the devs on the Skype team a little while ago. And we'll just call it Skype. They have a really cool office near San Francisco in the South Bay. So say cool guys, whatever. Couldn't think of something better. So I have a list of albums here. I can create a new album, which is also going to have to work with storage APIs on the back end, because when I use our storage APIs, I have these things called containers. And everything has to be stored within a container. So if I create a new album, it will create a container for me. So I'm just going to choose my existing one. And now I'm going to say upload and say another prayer. And so what this is actually going to do is it's going to add an entry. This weird bug is back. This went away and now it came back. Interesting. Okay, let's just see if the back end worked. I'm first failed demo of the day, hopefully the last one. What it was doing is it was going and creating. I have a table on the back end which you can see here, called picture. And it was creating a new picture entry. And we're going to look at the script that's running on the back end. But what that picture entry does is it creates two SAS URLs, which can be used for uploading a thumbnail and a full-size picture. And it then gives that back to the client, so the client can actually use that and invoke the Azure SDK for Win8 on the mobile app to then go and upload to that URL, which it could not do without the token. So if I come here, I have picture, and let's just look at the script that's running for the picture. So it actually did succeed. There's a timing issue. I think it may be a latency problem. There's a timing issue. But you can see here that it got these thumbnail URLs and the image URL. And these URLs it would not have unless it managed to successfully call against the service. So let me just do this to show you. One second here. That's not what I wanted to do. Come on. Okay, so here's Skype. Cool guys. If I go here, I should be able to copy that. There we go. So this URL, this My Pictures whatever, is a SAS URL. You see it has like this GUID in there, or it has like an encryption key that, or it has a key or a token that it will use. And this thing will expire. We're not going to diagnose why it failed, because for the sake of this demo, it's not really important. But if we come into the script, let's see what the script is doing. So this script is kind of interesting because it is both actually still writing to the database. So you could write scripts that actually don't even write to the database at all. But this is actually still going to store some data in the database. But before it writes to the database, it's going to work with the Azure module. So the way that I access modules in Node is I use this command called require. For any of you guys who've done client-side JavaScript development, you may have seen this if you've used things like require.js. It's a common pattern. This basically is like, give me this module. Now, you notice that I didn't do anything special to make the module available. It's just there, because that is one of the modules that we provide out of the box. And then it's requiring this query string module, and that's actually something that's built in to Node. So that there's nothing special there. So when I work with the storage APIs, I have to have a storage account. So if I go to the Azure portal again, when I went to create this, the first thing I did was actually create a storage account. And I managed that in the storage section of the Windows Azure portal. So the one that we're using is this one, Gblock Pick SCA, SCA for Southeast Asia. OK, so if I click on that Gblock SCA, you'll see that I have Manage Access Keys. This is giving the storage access key for my account. You never give this out to anybody. But my app needs this to be able to create the container, if the container doesn't exist, where the documents will go. So if we look at what it's doing here, I've just plugged in that account name and that account key. And remember, this is all private, so I don't have to worry about anybody having access to this, because this is the internals of my app. It's not publicly exposed to a user. And now I'm coming up with a container name. I'm coming up with a convention that says that the container name is going to be based on my pictures and the album. So we also have an album table. When I go to create a new album, it creates for me an album which gets stored, and that album has an ID. So then what it's doing is it needs to come up with the blob name itself. So it's creating these two relative path variables. It's saying that, hey, on the JSON object that came in, so the way these scripts work, you saw me modify the item and add a created date. Remember that? I modified the item and I said, hey, I want to add a timestamp. So that's that JSON object. So what it's doing is saying, hey, I want to pull out the album ID, I want to pull out the file name, and I want to pull out the thumbnail file name, which was sent from the client to my mobile service. The next thing it's going to do is it's going to instantiate the blob service off of the Azure module. So this blob service, it doesn't do anything yet. It's completely passive. Think of it as an accessor. It's like a factory. It's going to say, OK, I'm now going to give you the ability to work with blobs. But it hasn't done anything yet, other than initialize itself based on the account information that I passed in, which is what it needs to be able to work with my blob account. Now I'm going and I'm saying, hey, we have this nice convenience method called create container if not exists. And the reason for this is in Node, everything is async. So as soon as you move to an async world, the one thing that you regret is things initially that used to feel really easy, like just doing a for loop and processing a bunch of things, gets hard. Because all those things need to run async. And you need to wait until one finishes before the other run runs, unless you want to run them in parallel. If you want to run them in parallel, that's pretty easy. But if you want to run them sequentially, it gets kind of painful. So to make that easier, we've added this convenience method, create container if not exists, which means that you can call it all the time. If the container doesn't exist, it will create it. If it does exist, it'll just be no op. And when you start to write Node programming, you end up working with callbacks. So this is an example of a callback. This is saying that when it's completed looking to create the container or verifying if the container is already there and just moving on, it's going to then invoke this function. And it's going to pass me an error object that I can check to see if an error occurred. So once you move into this async world, the whole idea of just throwing errors is not the way it works. It's more like passing error state once something completes, because you're not running in a, you know, you basically have multiple things going on at the same time when you're in an async world. So then what I'm doing is I'm going to work with, once I'm done getting the container created, I need to now get my SaaS URLs. So I have this function here called create access policy. And if I scroll down to see create access policy, you'll see that I'm setting up some permissions. I'm saying that this URL that I'm going to give you is only going to have permission to write. It's a one-time operation. It's only going to have permission to write. And I'm saying that the thing is going to expire in 5 minutes. So in this example, I actually have this function, this convenience function, minutes from now, which is calculating what the date will be in that time period. We've actually made it now so that you don't have to write this kind of code anymore. We'll get into this a little bit later, but anyway. So once I've done that, then what I'm going to do is call this function twice, create resource URL with SAS. And I'm going to call one for the picture and the other for the thumbnail. And so if we drill through this, it calls this get SAS function. And this is calling new shared access signatures. So what this is actually going to do is I'm going to generate a SAS, which the client can then use to be able to talk back to Azure. This doesn't require making a service call. You may say, well, where's the async there? As long as you actually have the credentials, as far as having the storage account key and the storage account name, you can actually create SAS. It's an algorithm. You know, it's kind of like private public key kind of thing. And the server can know whether or not that key was actually valid or not. That's why there's no callbacks there. But the logic is pretty complicated, so you're going to want to use the module to do that. Okay, so do we get what was going on there? I wrote this script on the back end mainly so that, it stores information and data for my client app. It's storing the images that get created, what their names are and things like that, and what their URLs are. But it's also going further, and it's using the Azure module to then create for me a shared access signature that I can then use to allow the client to be able to upload the image. Any questions on this? And who is completely lost? Oh, yes. Did you have a question? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, why doesn't the service just call the blob directly rather than go back to the client?
That's a choice. So it's not uncommon nowadays in terms of reducing latency and things like that to actually have clients talking directly. These services, Blob is basically an HTTP service, and it's fine for the client to talk directly to it. But you could elect to move that to the server if you wanted to. But basically, the reason why you probably don't want to do it, you're going to be uploading twice. You're going to be first uploading the file to the server to then have the server have to stream that or upload that up. So it's less latency, actually, to have the client just do it directly. Does that make sense? But you could. There's nothing that would stop you from doing that. And we give you the APIs to actually work directly with Blob Storage. Just like I'm doing within the client app, I could do the exact same logic on the server to actually upload to that blob. Any other questions? Does this make sense? OK. Good. All right. So we saw the first example. The second one, sending an email. So I talked about this SendGrid service and how I could use that to basically send emails. So I have a version of our to-do list application. And the scenario is that whenever an item gets created, I want to basically send an email. And I'm going to utilize the SendGrid service to do that for me. So the first thing I have to do is provision my SendGrid account. So in Windows Azure, we actually have this thing called the Azure Store. And if you look on the portal, you'll see this thing called add-ons. Let me switch over. You can see add-ons is highlighted now. And you can see that I've gone ahead and I've created a SendGrid service. But if I didn't have a SendGrid service created, I could just add it. And it offers all of these services, well, most of these services offer kind of a freemium model, where you have free to get going and try it out up to a certain point, and then you can pay depending on what you want to do. If you're going to want to do blasts of like 10,000 emails a day, believe me, you will be paying. But if you just want to play with it and get going, they'll give you a couple of thousand a month, I think, to just mess around. So once you create your SendGrid account, you click on connection info. And don't worry, I will delete this later, so you will not be spamming my account. And you'll only be able to go up to 5,000 anyway. So it gives me a username and it gives me a password. So I now have another version of that same service that you guys looked at. called what? Called GB to-do list. No? Is that it? Yeah, that's it. So if we come in here, there's my to-do item. It's just like the one we used before. But I'm going to click on the script. And now you'll see that instead of requiring the Azure module, I'm requiring the SendGrid module. This is the module that we offer out of the box for you to work with. And then what I'm doing is, so this is a little bit different. So previously, I've showed you where I've done some things like modifying, modifying an entry, like adding created at, et cetera. And we called request.execute. But request.execute actually will accept a callback. And what that callback, now this is a little bit different than, this is closer to the callback style that JavaScript client developers are used to. Node takes a pattern of where you pass it a callback, and that callback takes an error object and a response. For this API, and there was a reason why we did this, but I won't get into detail on it, you pass it a JSON object that has a success on it. And we will automatically plug in an error handler if you didn't. That's why we didn't go with the callback model, because it's not really able to be composed. I can't really modify your callback. If you didn't pass the error, you're just not going to get it. So what I'm doing here is I'm saying, hey, once the insert has completed, you can respond back to the client. And what that does is basically end off the request, so I'm ready to receive other requests. And then it's going to call send email, which is this JavaScript function here. So you can see that I've newed up the SendGrid object, and I'm passing it the credential information. I'm passing it that the username and the password. That you're not going to remember that username, so I'm not too worried. And then I'm calling SendGrid.send, and I'm just giving it an arbitrary email to go to. And the message is going to say, hey, this new item was created. That's it. So let's go run that one. So I'm going to close Xcode. Yep. And so, let me see, where is it? There it is. So this is basically the same app. The reason I could have used the one that was there before. I would have had to just go in and change the information that it uses to connect to the mobile service, which is the mobile service name, and there's a key that you get in the portal. So I'm just going to run this. So it doesn't look like there's anything in the hat. So I just added this. And I just added this, so I was right. So what I'm going to do is, should take a few seconds. This is my email account that it's actually going to send to. There we go. So that's pretty cool. I can basically just blast off emails now utilizing that service. There's other services you could use, like Twilio. Maybe you want to send an SMS message to somebody's phone. We don't have great support right now for the Twilio actually does have a module, but there's some things we need to work around. But you can just generate an HTTP call because of the fact that Twilio is an HTTP API. If you have your credentials, you can actually use the built-in request module to create an HTTP request to Twilio to do something like SMS. But request is also interesting because request is a general purpose HTTP client. So you could even call out to your own APIs or any APIs that are out there if you want to within your scripts. So those are kind of some of the built-in modules. There's a deeper list of built-in modules that we have if you go to our documentation. which is on the Windows Azure portal. Sorry, the Dev Center. So the Dev Center you hit by doing windowsazure.com, and you go to documentation, and there's mobile services. And then there's a bunch of walkthroughs and things on how to do things like use SendGrid. I actually copied this for the sample. But we also have reference documentation, and we'll show you all the different server APIs that we have. If you look at this server script, you can see like requests that I was telling you about. And you'll see a whole bunch of built-in modules that we offer you. Before we go to the next step, one thing we didn't touch on is everything that I've shown you so far has been these data-bound things where I have a table and I want to do some logic in between that, maybe before or after. And as I mentioned, it's full CRUD. So you can do stuff on insert, you can do stuff on read. You can do some pretty interesting things, even joining up tables to create more complex graphs when you return them. But sometimes you want to do stuff that has nothing to do with a database. It's more of like an action-oriented thing. If there are any Rastafarians in the audience, they'll want to kill me, and all my friends will want to kill me. But it's true, right? You just want to say, do something, and there's no table or anything. So we actually have the ability to create what are called custom APIs. And a custom API is just a place where you can write handlers for get, put, post, delete, different types of HTTP methods. But it's not loaded to actually expect to write to a database. So you don't have to worry about execute or any of those other kinds of things. It's just an API that you do whatever you want on it. And we're going to see some examples of that in a few minutes. But I just wanted to mention it so you know about it. And you can go here and say, hey, create a custom API. Oh, let's just call it test. And I can set up my permissions to say that everyone can have access to it, which means they don't even have to be authenticated. And this will go and create for me a different type of script. Just take a second. That I can then attach logic to, but it's not bound to any kind of database. So that's a great question. Mobile services actually does not care about the UI at all. We give you a set of SDKs and an HTTP API for talking to your mobile service. We do generate for you a boilerplate starter app. That's just to get you going. How you build the UI out is really up to you. So we don't get in the way, but we don't help you there either. We give you an SDK that you can use, that you will use within your UI. And we make it easy to say, hey, I want to go get this collection of things from the server. You can do filtering and a bunch of other stuff. But it's really on you. We're not trying to be an end-to-end that does everything. We're assuming you know what you're doing on the client. We just want to be really good at giving you what you need for the server. Does that make sense? So yeah, don't be fooled by the getting started app. That's all that is. There's no other magic UI libraries or anything that we've created. So I can click on this script, and you can see here that by default it's just saying hello world. And it looks a little bit different. So in the API model, we give you one script where you can put all your handlers for your different HTTP methods. And for those of you that are familiar with Node.js, this is actually built on top of Express, which is a well-known web framework for building like web applications and APIs in Node.js. So you can see here that it's returning me this message of hello world. So because of the fact that I set the permissions to allow anybody to be able to access this, I can actually go right in my browser and access this API. So this API is called test. So I'm going to go here and say https gbtodolist.azuremobile.net/api/test. Let me see if I did that right. To-do list, yeah. Oh. What did I do? Ah. Yeah, and that's a nasty error too. I've sat there like debugging my network connection when really it was just the URL. Okay, so here's an API that it just can easily be accessed by anybody, and I've unsecured it. And you may have cases where you want this, where you say, hey, I want to make my APIs really easy for somebody to just open up and read in the browser as long as it's not really secure data. But I can just as easily lock this down. So just to anybody who's having a heart attack saying, oh my god, but what if that's like critical functionality? So I can go here on permissions, and all I got to do is flick this back and say, hey, you must have the app key. Now, the app key is not that secure either. It's not a secure secret. It's just a unique ID for your app. But I can lock it down further and say, hey, you actually have to be authenticated. And if I lock that down and I try to go refresh, you'll see that I'll get back a 401 that tells me that I'm unauthorized, which is the HTTP way to basically tell a client that, hey, you need to send me some credentials, bud, to be able to use me. So I'll go and refresh. You can see I got an error of unauthorized. But again, nice for development and for staging that I can open up all that stuff so I can just introspect it with the browser. All right, so we are running out of time. What do we have till 3? And we are way behind. So we're going to try to, I'm going to try to move fast now because I've only covered the basics of working with the built-in modules. So let's move on. Let's move quickly. So the portal is great for simple things. But what happens when your app really starts to grow? You don't want everything living in a single file either. You really want to like make that code. I mean, maybe you do. I won't hire you, but maybe you do. But most likely, as your app's going to grow, you're going to not want to be restricted to having to work in the browser for a bunch of different reasons. You want to be able to have more flexibility of tools that you use. Maybe you're using Visual Studio, or you know, you're using Sublime Text if you're doing JavaScript stuff, or you're using WebStorm, or whatever you want. So we have this feature called Source Control. And what Source Control allows you to do is have a Git endpoint for your mobile service. You can then clone that, and you will get access to all of your source files that are available in the portal. You can edit that, and then you can commit it, and you can push, and it works just like you would expect any Git repo to work. That gives me the flexibility to break outside of the portal and work in my favorite text editor of choice, or IDE. It's better for team collaboration because multiple people can work at the same time. It gives you a fail-safe. Why? Because I can roll back. I can't roll back with my scripts. If somebody comes in and cuts and pastes something and screws it up, that's it. My app is broken. And hopefully I copied it somewhere. But with this, I actually get all the capabilities of Git and more. And the big more is the ability to use other node modules that are not built in the box, which I'm going to show you now. But I need to move really, really fast. So if we take this particular app that was created, and we move into the dashboard. Oh, thank you. That was rude enough. That was perfect. You can see I have this option to set up source control. So if I click on set up source control, it gives me this warning message. We recommend you back up your scripts regularly, blah, 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 because this is a preview feature today, which means that we're making it available, but it is not yet to the level of where we think it's completely solid. It has been working very, very solid, but we're just giving disclaimers in case your stuff gets corrupted. Make sure you back it up. So once I'm done with this, it's actually going to come up and say, hey, you have an end. Well, what happened there? Did I not hit? I hit no? Oh, no, it's still configuring it. Yeah, OK. There we go. So it's now configured it. It's given me a Git URL. I can go and clone that URL. So I can come into my terminal here. I'll just do it right here. So I can say git clone. And then it's going to prompt me for my username and my password, which I can configure in the portal. And once I'm done, it's actually going to have cloned all my files locally into a local repo. So here's GB to-do list. And you'll see that when you drill in, there's a service folder. So I'm going to just add that into my favorite editor, which is Sublime Text. Anybody here use Sublime? Cool. But it didn't work, so that's interesting. Let's see. Just it's hiding. Where is it hiding? Just 1 minute. Yeah, it's just acting weird. Let's do that again. Oh, I'm doing Git. Not enough sleep. All right. So you can see here that I've got a folder structure with API. We didn't cover scheduler, but the ones that are interesting is I have table, and I can click on toDoItem.insert, and you can see that's the same code that was running in the portal for sending the mail. I can make a change to it, and it will actually sync back, and it will be in sync in the portal. So if I say a new interesting to-do item, now that's, you know, probably a bit of a stretch, but you know, we'll just assume that every item that gets added is interesting. So I'm now going to commit this. I'm going to assume you know what source control is, even if you don't know what Git is. But Git is source control. So I'm going to now push this, which is the way that I take my code that's local and push it back up to the main repo. And then I'm going to head over to my to-do list and click on the scripts. And I should see my updated script in there. New interesting to-do item. So source control is really, really nice. But the real sweet spot for source control is that now I'm able to add node modules that are not built in, and I can start to leverage those node modules within my app. So I gave you an example of some of the whitelists that we have, like for working with SendGrid and other kinds of things. But what if I want to work with MongoDB or Redis or the host of tons of things that are out there? That's going, you know, or maybe I want to work with geolocation services. There's just lots of different services out there that have modules. And once you use source control, you now have the ability to tap into that world. So I'm now going to show you that. So this is just a quick summary, by the way, of how you work with Git, what you saw me do. You enable your Git endpoint, you clone your repo, author your scripts in your favorite editor, go and commit them, and push. So the NPM registry. So the NPM registry I showed you before, there's 40,000 different modules. And there may be some really useful functionality there that you'd like to use within your mobile service. Like what? Well, one of the things you'll find when you work with Node is there's no built-in abstraction in Node for creating a GUID. You have to write that code yourself. Or utilize the very popular node-uuid module. It will create a GUID for you. Real easy, just pull it in and you can use it. Maybe you want to talk to MongoDB, I mentioned this. Use Redis. Parsing static pages. This gets where you start to have some really interesting capabilities. One of the things people really like Node for is you can actually execute JavaScript on the server. So they do like screen scraping, where you go to a web page and you parse it into some HTML, and you manipulate it, or you pull some data out. So all of these things that I've listed here, and this is just the beginning, are now, you're able to now do them thanks to the source control feature. Let's see how many of them I can get through in the remaining 10 minutes. Let's start with MongoDB. So what's the scenario going to be? I have no table. What I want to do is, I have an application that can talk to MongoDB in Azure. I'm not going to walk through the creation of the MongoDB, but you would use the store just like you use the store for doing the SendGrid. So you can see here that I have this task list API here. And this is actually using a node module called Mongoose. So I went and installed this module. I cloned this repo. Let me just show you. Let me go here. OK, so this is GB Mongo list. So I've cloned my repo, and I've got this API called task list. Sorry. So it's using Mongoose, which is like an ORM for working with MongoDB. It's a really lightweight library that can talk to a NoSQL DB, but it gives you back objects. So I've put in my connection string. Now, this is interesting. I'm doing this require here. I'm not requiring a conventional module. I'm actually just requiring a file within my repo. So one of the other advantages of using the source control is you can now break up your own logic into separate files that you can then use require to include. You can even put them in their own subfolders if you want to for organization. And you will. Not just you can, you will. So now what I'm doing is I'm exposing an API that will be accessible through the browser that is going to talk to that MongoDB using Mongoose and return a task. We're really into the task thing. This is a little bit different than to-do list, but same idea. So to show you what the tasks are, I actually have a Node app running on my machine called MongoList, which is a Node Express app. I could deploy this to the cloud, but I'm not deploying it to the cloud. So I'm just going to open it. And you can see that I have this task to present in Oz, which I am doing right now. And it is not completed. I will mark it as complete when I'm done. But I also have this mobile service with this API that should read from the same place. So let's see if that works. So I'm now going to go and do HTTPS GB Mongo list, azuremobile.net, table, task list. Oh, no, API, sorry. So there's a convention with how these URLs work. I'm doing an API now, so I just do API. So that JSON may not look very pretty, but it basically means that my API successfully connected to MongoDB and pulled that same data down. And this, now I could connect to MongoDB using an HTTP API, but it's going to be faster if I use the Mongo module because it knows how to talk. Mongo has a protocol, like over TCP/IP, that is a much more compact and more efficient protocol. So that's why I would want to use the module. Plus, it hides a lot of the complexity, even if I was going to build the HTTP URL. Make sense? How many people here have actually heard of Redis? So Redis is really, really cool, right? It's an in-memory cache, and it's distributed. And it's really, really fast. That's its key thing. It's a key value store, but it's more than a key value store. And I'm going to show you an example of using it in a non-pure key value store mechanism. So what I have is I have a products catalog with dummy data in it. So I can go HTTPS, what did I call it, GB products. I should just know these. I named them all with GB for a reason. So gbproducts.azuremobile.net, and I can go product. Oh, yeah. You're right. I did it as an API. That's very good because I'm not using table. No, actually, it's table. This is a table. It's not an API. Let me look here. GB products data. Tables. It's tables. There we go. Okay, so there's my product data. It's dummy. The data doesn't really matter. But here's the scenario. So imagine this catalog has a million items in it. It's really big. It's like Best Buy catalog or whatever. Okay. What I want to do is I still am using Azure SQL, as you can see, for storing the items. I'm not putting those items in the cache. But where Redis is really nice is I can utilize it for tracking stats. I want to know what were the most recent 5 items that were looked at. I want to know how many times each item has been looked at. Which ones are the popular ones? And this is the kind of thing that if I want to really have good throughput, you know, I'm not going to write to my database every time somebody reads. That's a sure way to kill your performance. But with Redis, I can safely make calls because, one, it's orthogonal to the database. The database transaction is just going to go, but because of the fact that it's in memory and it's very, very fast. So what I have here is I can go to tables and like access, let's say, product 1, and then I'll access product 3. And now I'm going to go to my API, and I'm going to access recent. And so what you're seeing there is the IDs of the products that I accessed most recently, but there's only 5 there. But I am not doing anything of writing to the database to store that information. That information is getting sent to Redis and retrieved from Redis. But I can also look at an individual product. So I can say that I want to look at stats for ID equals, oh, not states. Is it stats? It's still going. Why is it taking so long? Should be done. It's going to time out. All right. So let me show you how Redis is working here. This will, it's still, what did it do? Did it finish? No. Let me look at this. Just make sure I use the right thing. So here's stats. And it is looking for product ID. Yeah, it should be ID. Oh, it's still going. I don't know. It's having some type of latency issue. Let's just try one other thing. Oh, there we go. OK, so now we're getting values back. Because those other ones were not pages that were viewed. That's why. So this has been viewed 6 times. So let's look at how this is working. I was just checking this to see why it wasn't working. So I'm going to go into my table, my product table. Now I've gone and provisioned a Redis instance into Azure. We don't yet have Redis as a service in Azure, though that is coming. But what we do have that's really awesome is an open source depot called VM Depot. And we have Bitnami, which has, there's a whole bunch of third parties that are adding images here. But here's an example of the Redis 269 image. This is a VM image that is fully loaded with Redis. So all you've got to do is install this image into a VM in Azure, and you've got a Redis instance up and running. You don't have to connect to it, SSH in, or anything like that. And it gives you everything you need to set it up. You have this option to create a deployment script. So if I click Southeast Asia here, this is giving me a command that I can use our Azure command line tool. We have a command line tool written in Node called Azure that you can install on your machine. And you can find out about that in our dev center. And this will give you the command that you need to basically set up your own Redis instance. So I did that. And then if I come into my product table and I look at what I'm doing, I'm not on read. I am basically instantiating the Redis module. You see here I'm requiring Redis. So what I did, just to drive this home, is if I come into my source, let's see here. If I go into my Zumo folder here, you'll see that I have a, where is my Redis thing? GB products. There we go. We'll be done in like 2 minutes. In my service folder, you'll see that I actually have a node modules folder. And that's because I used NPM, the node package manager, to install Redis for me. So I just did NPM install Redis, and that's what I ended up with. And you'll want to install modules in your service folder, because if you do that, they'll be available to your scripts and your APIs and everything else, because Node resolves by walking up the hierarchy. So you can put stuff in a higher level folder that will be available to all your scripts. But anyway, once I have required the Redis module, I can then create the Redis client, which is what I'm doing here. And I'm giving it the port information and the URL of my VM. This is the VM that I created using that command that I just showed you a minute ago. And then on read, I'm actually going and doing the read. So I'm not blocking that. But I'm saying, hey, if you passed an ID in, so if you get a list, I'm not going to record anything. But if you looked at an individual item, because I'm expecting that's a user who's browsing through the catalog, then what I'm going to do is I'm going to utilize the Redis module to say, I want to push onto this list called recent an ID, the ID of the product that's being viewed. And then what Redis has that's really nice, and it can do this with lists of 1,000 or 5,000, it can instantly trim that list so that it never has more than five items in it. I could make that 10, I could make that 100, whatever. And then what I'm doing, and this is really nice, is I am safely incrementing for that particular product and query ID. So Redis is a key value store, so I've stored something for each product that has a number next to it. And this will go and increment that value because it's now been looked at. I want to increment it. But it does it in a very safe way that even if there's lots of transactions happening at the same time, what Redis ensures is that the updates always happen from a Redis perspective in memory synchronously so that you don't have to, you know, so multiple transactions can happen and they'll work just fine in this case. They're not going to clobber over one another. Redis is a persistent backing store, so it will store that information out of band, but it's not requiring to store. That's where it's different than a conventional database. It's not requiring to persist that information right away when I go and do that update. So that's that. And then if I go into my API and I look at like recent, for example, you can see that I'm using Redis again in the API to then go and get those five items out of that list so I can display them or return them, which is what you saw there. All right, so we are pretty much out of time, but we did get through a lot of what I wanted to get through. There's one demo that I didn't get to show you, but that was because we went into the basics more than I had expected. So just a couple of tips about NPM. This is a key one, that third bullet. We only support Node 0.6 right now in mobile services. Most of the modules that are out there still support that. But you want to make sure. You want to verify. Or if you see some errors happening, it might be that it's because that module just doesn't support the Node version that we have. But that will be fixed soon. We'll soon have a lot more flexibility. We also do not support native modules. Node has these native modules, which are written in C++. We don't support native modules. There's not too many of them that you absolutely need, but there are a few that are out there that are popular. We don't support those today, so if you try to put those in, it's going to fail. So in summary of what we learned really today is just that, hey, there's a bunch of modules in the box for common scenarios. You want to enable source control. It opens up a world of things for how you can maintain your code, work with Git, et cetera. And it opens the ability to leverage the NPM registry, which will give you a universe of modules that you can use within your applications. And you can go win a mouse by giving me your session evals. And for those of you that were experts in Node, I thank you for bearing, or experts with mobile services, I thank you for bearing with the kind of intro so we could take the rest of the people along. Thank you guys very, very much. You've been great. And here's more information on Windows Azure. Thank you.